Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Harry Dent. Mr. Dent is a New York Times best-selling author, known for his ability to look at past cycles and demographics to project what's next for the economy and where to most wisely invest. One of his most famous calls was writing a book in 1992 entitled The Great Boom Ahead, when most of the authors were writing about a repeat of a Great Depression. In 2008, Harry wrote a book projecting a Great Depression. His most recent work is The Great Crash Ahead. Mr. Dent, welcome to our show.
Nice to be here, Bruce.
I appreciate that. You know, I just wanted to start with, I think you've earned a lot of credibility for two reasons in my mind. First, your projections leave nothing to the imagination as to the direction you're predicting, which I appreciate. If I interview or if I read books sometimes, I'm not really sure when I'm done what was just said, and I've never had any doubt what you felt. And that takes a lot of guts to say it's going to go this way, because sometimes it doesn't.
Exactly. That's why people don't be too clear, because they don't want to be wrong.
Exactly. You can never be really right, but you can never be really wrong.
Right.
I appreciate you taking one or the other direction. And secondly, you have projected both extremes, both positive and negative, and I don't think that's usual as well. Sometimes people get a branding where they're the negative guy, so that's what's expected of them. And you really have been on both sides of the fence with predictions that are, you know, really strong on both directions. And so I'm just curious, do you find that that's an unusual thing as well?
Yeah, no, I do. Most people are generally bullish or generally bearish. And I'm like, first of all, I wasn't an economist to begin with, more of a business consultant, business strategy person. And I'm like, hey, the world is growth historically is exponential and cyclical, end of story. So if you don't see ups and downs, then you don't understand the economy at all. From my view.
In the book that I read again last night, there was a sort of a headline. It said the last forecast Great Depression of the 1990s that wasn't. And there were any number of books that were written, The Great Depression of 1990, The Great Reckoning, Bankruptcy 1995. And this was your quote. He said, these authors understood much more about long-term economic cycles than do most respected economists today. And I guess when you wrote the 92 book, The Great Boom Ahead, you had to really fly in the face of, it sounded like, people that you respected.
Yeah, I read all his book. I read The Great Reckoning cover to cover a number of times, all of Robert Precht's books. Because, yeah, these people look back at history. I mean, you go up at 30,000 feet and the world doesn't look flat anymore, you know. It looks round, and people just miss perspective. And anybody that looks at history knows, first of all, I mean, every stage we go through, every new paradigm in technology, I mean, things just leap. I mean, we exponentially can do things our parents and grandparents couldn't have done. And then you go back farther in history, it's unbelievable how crudely people lived. But you also see the cycles. Every great boom is followed by a great bust. Every debt bubble, every bubble eventually burst. And these people see that. It was just a matter of timing in that case. They were studying the Kondratieff wave, which used to be a 50 to 60 year cycle, about a human lifetime. Well, in our lifetime, it's been stretched to 80 because our lifetimes have been stretched. And the baby boom generation is much larger than the generations driving past booms. And of course, the technologies are more powerful. So, you know, since I was studying demographics, I could see that there was no way we were going to have a Great Depression or downturn in the 1990s. In fact, out of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that was the strongest decade for rising baby boom spending as people got older, earned more money, buy their houses, do all this sort of stuff. So I had that advantage. But long term, going backwards and then going out further in the future, I mean, now I'm calling for a depression, just like they were in the 90s. And Robert Precht is calling for a depression and deflation. You know, because we look at history. And if you look at history, the cyclicality is clear. And every time we get in a boom and you know, there's a new economic theory or something, everybody says, well, you know, now we don't have to have recessions anymore. That is the ultimate famous statement. Or now things are different, as Ken Rogoff said in the title of his book. No, they're not. I mean, human nature is to get overly optimistic when things go too well, too long, and bubbles develop. And then when those bubbles burst, things fall apart. And that's not bad. This cyclicality is actually great for technologies and human learning and everything. That the more we have this cyclicality, the more innovation thrives. So free markets need this, and governments are literally trying to stop the free markets from working because they don't want to admit they allowed a debt bubble and a real estate bubble and a stock bubble to get out of hand like they did in the Roaring Twenties.
When you find yourself in a position in the early 90s disagreeing with people that you respect, I mean, what is your original reaction to that? When you said you reread those books, is it, I've really got to check and make sure that I'm right, or you really think, okay, I've found a piece that hasn't been included in their work?
Yeah, no, that's the difference. I can understand their work, and I agree with them, like I say, backwards and longer term going forward. But yes, I had stumbled onto something in the early 80s, developed it in the 80s, and by the time we got to the late 80s, yeah, I was crystal clear that we were going to have a boom that was going to last until at least 2007. I was crystal clear we were going to see falling inflation rates, not deflation, and certainly not going to have a Great Depression. I mean, to me, there wasn't even a chance of a Great Depression in the 1990s, unless, you know, something really radically happened politically. So I could say, look, I understand why they see what they see, but I do see something they don't see. And I went to a seminar once that was so crazy. They said, it's not what you know, it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that gets you, that kills you. These people, and Robert Prechter Day, as much I respect him, he just doesn't get demographics. He doesn't think it's important. I'm like, how could you not? With the baby boom, 100 million people, you know, raising kids, earning more money, buying houses, borrowing money, how could you think that doesn't impact the economy and it's just a social wave? He puts it in social waves, Elliott wave. Well, the baby boom is a big social wave. And you know, he thought we were having a fifth wave in 1989. Well, I think we're having a fifth wave in some markets in 2007 and other markets in 2013 here. But, I love Elliott Wave. But Elliott Wave is not a cause and effect thing. It's a pattern. And that pattern can shift or change or morph. Demographics don't morph. People enter the workforce at age 20, 21 today. They earn and spend more money till they're age 46. They kind of plateau into their early 50s and they drop like a rock. This is pure cause and effect. Growing numbers of people, spending money at certain rates, buying houses at certain times, having kids at certain times, going to college at certain times, savings at certain times, borrowing against those houses. I mean, this is all predictable stuff. I mean, life insurance actuaries don't say, well, we're just taking a kind of a rough guess. They know when people are going to die at any point in time, down to the decimal point on average. The secret to what we do in demographics and economics is nobody knows what any individual is going to do. But when you average people out in different incomes or different, it's as predictable as life expectancies.
One of the things that was in one of the books I read, they had a chart where the peak potato chip age was, and I just had to laugh. I said, "Wow, that's pretty refined."
By the way, we the Consumer Expenditure Survey, where we get a lot of our data, we also get it from marketing associations where they don't cover it. 600 categories they measured, down to potato chips. In age 42, average kids born to the average parent when they're 28. Calorie intake cycle peaks at 14, proven medical fact, 28 plus 14, 42. So not only can I see that in the charts, I can understand why it happens.
So you've had some fantastic right calls. What were some of the ones that didn't pan out?
Well, the biggest was in the late 90s and early 2000s. We called the first bubble, Dow 10,000, by the early 2000s, when people thought we were nuts, and back when the Dow was more like 2,000 to 3,000, and everybody thought the U.S. was sunset nation and Japan was going to take over the world. We also said Japan was going to have a major collapse in the 90s, which they did. But when we were getting towards the top of the first bubble, we said, look, we're going to have a correction, but we're going to have a second bubble, just like we did with automobiles in the last major technology cycle and then two generations back. And you know, the Dow is going to go to 32 to 35,000, you know, in the 2000s, in the Roaring 2000s. That book came out in 98. Well, we were right about a second bubble, but the bubble came in real estate. It came in emerging markets, commodities. there's so many new places in a global market to invest that the money just said, okay, we had our stock and tech bubble, forget that. You know, if we're going to boom again, we're going to go chase something better. So the stock market doubled, and we had people back in the market in October 2002. But we were saying the market was going to quadruple. It only doubled. Well, at least we're in the right direction. But and we're in a bubble time, and bubbles are the most difficult because every bubbles always go to more extremes. But that was the thing here. I mean, we were right. There was a second decade. Most people thought, just like in after the late 80s, we thought we were done after that crash. Well, everybody thought we were done after the tech wreck. And we said, no, baby boomers are going to keep, you know, keep our economy zooming, and new technologies have yet to penetrate internet, broadband, all these things, smartphones, cell phones fully. So we were going to have another boom. Everything else bubbled. The stock market only doubled. So we over-predicted that, and boy, have I gotten a lot of crap for that, I tell you.
I'm sure.
Get it.
Well, which is more helpful in the learning curve, being right or being wrong?
Well, there's no question being wrong.
Okay.
It's the same thing. People don't make bold forecasts because, you know, I mean, I just love to watch the mainstream, you know, brokerage firms, economists, Abby Joseph Cohen. Well, you know, if this happens of that and this and that and da da da. Since we're bearish here for the next year, I'm going to change my portfolio allocation from 68% stocks to 67. And I'm like, why even bother?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to be wrong. They don't want to look to be wrong. By being wrong, by taking risks, by being wrong, that's where you learn. When I over-forecast the Dow in the early 2000s and started to realize this just wasn't happening, the bubble was shifting. I missed that. Our earnings forecast went right where we thought, everything, the economy, but I missed that. I just didn't get that dimension. I found two new long-term indicators that I didn't have before, a 30-year commodity cycle and an alternating 18-year geopolitical cycle, because I had to go back and say, well, gosh, this did happen in the early 1900s and roaring 20s, right at the same time of the cycle, right at the same time of technologies emerging, right at the same time in the generation cycle. How come stocks didn't bubble up the second time? Well, the difference between the roaring 20s and the roaring 2000s was commodity prices were falling in the roaring 20s, which is good for stocks. They were rising in the roaring 2000s, a different cycle. And the geopolitical cycle was in a positive phase of 18 years in the roaring 20s, and it was in a negative phase from 9/11 forward in the roaring 2000s. So when I adjust for those two things, just that geopolitical cycle will tell you stock valuations will be roughly half of what they are in the positive cycle. That would have fixed my forecast. So, I mean, we weren't wrong on time. We were wrong on magnitude. So I found two powerful new cycles by being wrong. But I also had to dig. I mean, some people, I still see some people, I won't mention names, were saying, oh, we said the great, you know, downturn was going to happen 10 or 20 years ago, but you know, adjusted for gold or peanut shells, it really did happen. I mean, they're still in denial. Look, when we make a big mistake or miss something, and we don't make many big mistakes, but when we do like that, I just go dig and say, look, I must be missing something because I know X, Y, and Z are right. I know we were right about baby boom. I knew we were right about the economy coming back, all this stuff, interest rates falling. What did I miss? Well, I had to dig for a year and a half till I found, I missed these two big things. Wow. Well, that's cool. What have I found them?
Right. And what's important is you're building on something, that a tremendous base of what you know. Okay, this is how it works. And it kind of gets back to the quote that you have, and I'll say the whole thing, but it's really true. There are known knowns. There are things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things we know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns, and these are the things we don't know we don't know.
Yeah, that's where the insights are. I mean, I've seen people in seminars that realize they've been doing something all their life, you know, being mean to their wife or whatever, and they don't even know why, and then suddenly they realize, oh, my gosh, at age 4, you know, mommy said X to me, and I assumed this for the rest of my life, and I never realized I assumed that. And once they realize that, they don't have to do it anymore. It's what you don't know. And in anything, any field, and if you're not pushing the limits, if you just get a nice theory and then sit on it and just tie it up in bows and you know, refine it a little bit and don't keep pushing the edge, you're going to lose your edge. You're going to stop learning and getting these breakthrough insights that come from what you don't know. You don't know. That's where the break. In fact, George Gilder's got a new book out called Knowledge and Power. he defines information not as just normal information. He says real information is surprises. Surprises is, oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. That's where breakthroughs come from. Most innovation is just, okay, we know this, but now we study, we can make it a little better. Hey, that's great. That's what most people do in life. And some people screw things up, and that's what they do in life. But the breakthroughs from the entrepreneurs and the people that control 50% of the wealth, the 1%, those are the people that are willing to step, think out of the box and look for that, hey, what don't I know here? What do I not even know that I don't know? You got to push limits. If you stay in your box, you'll never see that.
That's what's fun about when people challenge something like what, or disagree or say they have a theory, and then you just ask, oh, I'd love to read the document that you wrote that in. And then you go, well, yeah, there isn't one. It's much tougher to put what you've studied in writing, because that's a pretty permanent thing. And like you say, there's always people that can look at it and say, okay, well, this didn't pan out. It's the learning process just to figure out what you just said, what was flawed, how do we correct it? And it's a never, at least I find, it's a never-ending process, and I'm sure you're not done either.
Well, you know, but it's my biggest criticism of the government right now. Okay, we had a big bubble. Hey, the government was part of that, but so were banks, so were mortgage brokers, so were consumers. Everybody played a part in the bubble. People love bubbles. You basically get, you know, a free lunch for a while until it falls apart. But ever since when it started to fall apart, now they just want to freeze the system, keep it where it is, not let debt deleverage, not let banks or businesses fail, you know, like AIG and stuff. And I mean, that you're killing the golden goose. You're taking the economy and try to make it a machine that just grows at 3%, 4% a year with 2% inflation. That's taking out the dynamics of boom and bust, inflation and deflation, success and failure, new innovations and creative destructions of old ones. That is what makes free market capitalism work. Democracy is a great opposite that balances that and forces the benefits to pass down to some degree to everybody. In the good old days, they didn't, by the way. You know, you see mafias, tribal leaders, dictators today that, you know, they make tons of money, but nobody else in their country or group benefits. And we had that with the landed aristocracy. That's why we had the American and French revolutions. We said, you know, off with your heads, you know. If you're going to innovate and, you know, the new technology is going to come along and you're going to control it and not let the benefits pass down, then we'll chop off your heads and start over again. And so, you know, we're killing the golden goose here by saying we won't have a recession or depression. We won't let debt deleverage. Look, in the 30s, we let debt deleverage massively. And we came roaring out of that, unlike this recovery. It was a worse downturn, 25% unemployment, stocks down 80%, you know, on and on. Real estate was down about 26 or 28, because real estate didn't bubble in the roaring 20s like it did here. We didn't have the financing
right,
to let
no
that
financing.
Out. Stocks did. 40% of bank lending in the late roaring 20s went to financing stock speculation. I mean, that's not a bubble waiting to burst. But the point is, it maybe was a little too brutal and government could have done more, but we washed out the system. We had a debt detox. We forced businesses to get more efficient, and all the innovations of the past decades and auto technologies and electricity, it all got more efficient, and then we just had a greater boom to follow. Well, what we're doing now is going into a coma economy like Japan's done for the last two decades. They should have been over their downturn in the early 2000s, and they're not. They never deleveraged their debt. The government added even more to protect banks and businesses and to keep the economy going through all this QE and stuff. And now they're just like they're basically, Japan's been zero growth, zero inflation. They're in a coma for decades. They're going nowhere, and they continue to age, which is bad. Don't encourage immigration, don't encourage births, and their debt is going up, not down. And, you know, after a bubble, you're supposed to deleverage your debt and get rid of it and take a weight off the backs of consumers and businesses. And then, so I hate what the government's doing. It's the most cowardly thing I've ever seen, the most short-sighted by very intelligent people. My view is they don't know anything about anything. It's almost like Jim Cramer. You're like, they know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the economy at all if they think they can turn it into a machine. Machines are machines. They're designed by humans. Economies are more like us. They're biological. They have to grow and contract. They have to inhale and exhale. They're not letting us exhale here.
When you wrote the book, The Great Depression Ahead, the stock market, you wrote that during 2008. And
yeah.
When did it come out, right? Like January 2009?
No, it came out, I think, about September or October. It came out in the latter part of 2008, but
okay.
You know, that book had to be written
March. Right, you're writing it way in advance. So
it was before the crash.
Right, so you were writing stocks are going to crash really at a number that was probably close to a peak at that point, or at least a flat peak, and then it got down below 7,000 in record pace. And I guess the question I wanted to ask was the drop that you predicted for the reasons you thought it would happen?
Yeah, it was, but the difference is, I mean, and I knew governments would stimulate. I mean, we've been kind of Keynesian economics has been in favor since the 1970s, even though it was invented back in the 30s. But I never thought that every major central bank in the world would just pull the stops totally and just print trillions and trillions. I mean, all the major central banks have printed about $12 trillion. The U.S. is now stimulating to the tune of $1 trillion a year in monetary stimulus, quantitative easing, and on average in the recovery, $1 trillion in fiscal deficit. That's $2 trillion a year in government stimulus, which is basically debt, to create $300 billion, you know, a 2% average growth rate since 2009, $2 trillion a year to create $300 billion in GDP. That is horrible. That's a horrible deal. That is so irresponsible. How can that not end badly? What business or bank would make that bet? What investment banker or venture capitalist would make that bet? Nobody.
So that's why
this is insanity, and everybody's saying it's okay, and Warren Buffett's saying okay. And, you know, Warren Buffett may be the best investor in all of history, but he doesn't know crap about economics either, if he's saying that.
Is that what was the great unknown? When we didn't have a Great Depression, it was... You couldn't have imagined the extent that the stimulus would go on globally.
Yeah, the extent, because in that book we said, look, there will be a bounce, you know, into 2009 or a little bit later. But, you know, our cycle suggests that we'd be headed back down in the early 2010s, like 2010, 11, 12. I mean, we expected there to be stimulus. I didn't expect it to be so endless and open-ended, and I didn't expect it to last that long. I thought the bond markets would have just said, you guys are nuts. We're raising interest rates. We think you're nuts. I mean, any investor that saw a bank or business doing that would say, we're shorting your stock.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did in Europe. Investors shorted the bonds in Southern Europe when they started doing all this irresponsible stuff and going under and not being able to pay their debts and need bailouts. And then same thing, the ECB, Mario Draghi, stood up and basically said, I will basically shoot on sight anybody that shorts European bonds.
Mm.
Okay, a temp. Okay, is that a solution? No, that's a stopgap, short-term, desperate measure, just like $2 trillion a year in the U.S., and the Japanese just tripled their stimulus after 23 years of coma economy, and it's having some impact. But this is really bad economics. This is. Can anybody do this? Can any of us do this in our own consumer economics? And can any business do the same thing? Oh, we got too much debt, so we're going to borrow more debt to pay off that debt. That's what governments are doing, and that they're even allowing businesses and banks to do that. Banks are now not loaning money. They're taking all this money injected by the Fed, investing it at high leverage, and making money as speculators. Now banks have turned into casinos. How can that be good?
So you still don't, and we only have 40 seconds left, you still don't see a happy ending for this, obviously. We'll get to
absolutely
that.
Absolutely not.
We'll get that in the second segment. Your latest book is The Great Crash Ahead?
Yeah, that came out in late 2011. Then I've got a new one coming out in January, tentatively titled The Demographic Cliff, but that may change.
Okay. All right. Do you have a website we can give everybody?
Yeah. HarryDent.com. You can get a free daily newsletter from us. We're not making all the short-term predictions there like we do in some of our other newsletters, but we're letting you know what we think on current issues and longer-term issues and stuff so you can get to know us better.
All right. Harry Dent, thank you very much for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.